I'm Terry Thornton, and I'm Curator of Education, and it's my great pleasure to be a part of such a wonderful program as Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. We have an exceptional lineup, I think, this fall, and I hope that you have been able to take advantage of the previous lectures and that you will mark your calendars for those that follow. We still have, I guess, three more lectures. Next week, the New York-based artist Donald Moffitt will be here to present his socially, politically charged abstractions that challenge the realms and history of painting, verging actually on sculpture as they carefully play their role in his multimedia installations. It's fascinating work, and I think you're sure to be informed and entertained when you come next week. Come early, of course, and get your ticket and take that opportunity to go through the galleries. The second floor exhibition is Hubbard and Birchler, No Room to Answer. It's a fascinating show, and I invite you to visit or revisit that before you come to the lecture next Tuesday. And tonight we have the great privilege of hearing from the Modern's own chief curator, Michael Opping, who has again graciously accepted my invitation to participate in Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Many of you have attended Michael's past presentations that have, for the most part, there are a few variations, but for the most part have offered insights into the scores of special exhibitions for which he has been responsible and of which we have been the beneficiaries. Exhibitions such as 110, in which the permanent collection which was the permanent collection exhibition that opened our new Ondo building. Let's see, the comprehensive and enlightening Philip Guston retrospective, the compelling Anselm Kiefer Heaven and Earth, and the stunningly beautiful Declaring Space, Mark Rothko, Barnett Newman, Lucio Fontana, and Yves Klein. I have to say that when I got up here to read my introduction, there's a note on my Kleenex from Michael that says, or I assume it's from Michael, that says he went to an okay school and got good grades. No. He went to an okay school and got okay grades. But I'm not going to stop there. For past introductions of Michael, I have run through the lengthy but impressive list of art world feats that is Michael Opping's resume, including his receiving the Distinguished Best Pavilion Award at the 44th Venice Biennale, in which he showed the work of Jenny Holzer, and so much more. I had to get that one in there. And while it's hard for me to exclude anything, it is impossible to mention it all, so this time I'm focusing on those accomplishments and contributions that most directly relate to tonight's presentation, Installing the Modern. In addition to the carefully plotted installations of the installation of the exhibitions that I've already mentioned, there are also the essays, interviews, and books that Michael has authored, including the ever-popular Seven Interviews, in which he shares insightful conversations with Tadao Ando throughout the design and building project. His most recent essay on Ondo is in the large format, fully illustrated book that we now have in our bookstore, Tadao Ondo, Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth, that was published last spring. There's also the important fact that as chief curator, Michael served on the building committee of this museum, which is a rare honor and responsibility that has no doubt informed his decisions in placing art throughout its galleries and public spaces. Currently, Michael is thoughtfully installing the collection on the first floor, and in January, he will continue with the second floor galleries, making hard decisions about how to best pair and yet set off works of art, making the most of this building's full potential. It is also a topic he addresses in the museum's upcoming quarterly publication, and one we are fortunate to have him here to expand on tonight. I just have to say before we join in welcoming Michael that it is in fact his great curatorial abilities that had him chosen for and assigned to the installation of the 2000 Whitney Biennial. And I can't do an introduction without mentioning that because it is a point of pride for me that and it's something that we all benefit from every time he installs an exhibition in this beautiful building. So please join me now in welcoming Michael Oppie.
Thank you. Well, it seems amazing to me that it's almost 10 years to the week that we first cleared the ground for this new Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. And when I talk to people today about it, 10 years later, you'd almost think that we knew what we were doing. We didn't. We operated on sheer will, faith, and a lot of intuition. And anyone who's ever built a building like this or been involved in building a building like this, they weren't really involved if they tell you they knew what they were doing. There's so much that you learn and so much that has to go on faith and intuition. What we had was a very flat piece of land. And you have to remember, we started from scratch. We had nothing but ambition and about $70 million of faith. But you need to start somewhere. You need to have a philosophy in terms of the kind of art you want to show, how you want to show it, and the kind of spaces you want to show it in. And the one thing we did have to push off on, not a piece of land that was that distinguished, but what we had was the Kimball Art Museum across the street, which is arguably one of the finest small museums in America, designed by Louis Kahn. And the Kimball is really based on the idea of light elegance. Light meaning that the building itself seems to float a little bit. It doesn't wear on you. It doesn't feel heavy. It's an elegant frame for art. And the director of that museum was a man named Rick Brown, Richard Brown. I call him Rick because I feel like I know him. I never met the man, but he was responsible, along with Kahn, for building the Kimball. And Rick Brown was the mentor of my mentor, a man named Jim Elliott, who is the director of the University Art Museum of Berkeley. And Jim couldn't stop talking about Rick Brown and the Kimball Art Museum when I was a young curator around 1976, 77. I didn't want to hear about it. Fort Worth, don't even know where it is. Kimball Art Museum, never heard of it. But he kept hammering on about Rick Brown, and Jim was known for his eccentricities. He was the best man at Klaus Oldenburg's wedding. He hung out with Andy Warhol on a regular basis. And in his office in Berkeley, he walked around barefoot. And in 1978, when Post-its were invented, the yellow things that you stick on things, Jim bought thousands of them. And all over his office, he had Post-its sticking up. You know, buy dog food. You know, go to the movies on Sunday. He used Post-its to remind himself of everything. And I remember one day in my office, there was a Post-it written by Jim. And it was a statement. And it said, "A museum should not make you count objects, but should ask you to quietly walk through your thoughts." And it wasn't signed, but underneath, it was the thoughts of the director of the Kimball Art Museum, basically. And I didn't think much about it at the time, but I kept the post-it until the glue wore off, and then I wrote it down later. And I thought, Rick Brown is right. Rick Brown is right. It isn't about objects. It's really about thoughts and walking through those thoughts in the museum. And he did that at the Kimball. And the question was for us, how do you accomplish that same thing in the late 20th century? And we did a long search, and with a lot of frequent flyer mileage, did a lot of research. And we thought we found the person who could do that for us, in Tadao Ando. Now, in the beginning, the attraction of Ando was a matter of materials. Kahn's basic vocabulary of materials was poured-in-place concrete, glass, and steel. On those materials are essentially poured in place concrete, glass, and steel. But there is something more about Ondo's work. There was a spirit about it that may have even taken Louis Kahn's thoughts to another level. And Ondo loved Kahn's work, revered his art, along with Corbusier and others. Now, at the same time, we were taking a chance with Ondo in a big way. It isn't like Ondo was a huge superstar at the time we hired him. Number one, he spoke no English and had no offices in the United States. You would think it would be difficult to communicate with someone who doesn't speak English about what your ideas are for the building. In fact, it's a long story and I won't go into it, but in fact it made it easier because everything had to be in writing. Also, at the time we chose Ondo, he really hadn't done hardly any major public museum buildings. What he had done were a series of beautiful homes, private homes. This is in Tokyo. And I remember sitting in this room and thinking, this is an unbelievable space. A really unbelievable space. But how would you install art in here? Would art feel comfortable in here the way I feel comfortable? And along with private homes, the other thing that he seemed to specialize in were churches. But what was so interesting about Ondo's spaces was, although they were poured in place concrete, there was an intimacy about all of his spaces. When you walked in, you felt special. And so it was really the curator's problem as to how to install things. As long as an architect can make a human who walks into that building feel special, then it's the curator's job to install things so that they're inspired to think about both the building and the art. And you talk about intimacy. Arguably, Ondo's most important building, or at least his most famous building, is only 2,000 square feet. And it's a small church on the outskirts of Osaka called the Church of the Light. And this is four slabs of concrete. This is a wall made of four slabs of concrete held together to form a cross. And this is the interior of the church. How can you not hire a guy like that? On the other hand, you know, is the art going to outstage or upstage? Is the building going to upstage the art? That was always the question with Ondo. It was never a question, is he a great architect or not? And that's always the question with any architect building a museum. But I began thinking that, you know, a guy who builds churches is probably just the right guy. I mean, in a fundamental sense, the church is a perfect model for a museum. And there are a lot of models you could use for museums. You could use a university, you could use the mall, you can use whatever civic building you want to think about. But the church is where art and architecture really first came together in a meaningful way. The church is the place where art and architecture took us, or took humankind to a place, to a spiritual place that was bigger than either one of those things individually. Bigger than art and bigger than the building. It took you beyond both. But it was the combination of both that sent you there. And so what we wanted to do was create something special. And there was also this idea in my mind, in the back of my mind, that a church, and I'll go back, you know, it has a nave, which is this large public area that you walk down, and then there are chapels. and that a museum could be this idea of sort of a public spine or a central spine with chapels on either side of the nave. Very corny idea, but not as stupid as it sounds. This is the entry to the galleries of a very well-known art museum here in the United States. And the problem with these galleries is that they look so much like a museum. So much like a museum that it hurts. And unfortunately, this slide is a little light. But what it is a series of white boxes that march back into space. I don't know about you, but when I enter galleries like this, the first thing that happens before I take one step is that my feet hurt. I'm thinking, a lot of white galleries, they all look the same, and I've got to walk from here all the way down to there. There's no imagination. It's a series of white boxes. What we wanted to do was create a situation that was more of a journey. And on a journey, you have unexpected things happen. And we wanted the unexpected things to begin at the very beginning. And this is a space around which there was a lot of discussion. This is the outside wall of our elliptical space in the museum. And there was a lot of discussion about this ellipse. Ondo had done ellipses in two other buildings before he did ours. And I had always thought they were terrific. And they provide a sense of animation to the beginning of your journey when you walk down our galleries. Now, some people stop right here and go, whoa, curved wall, what's that about? I thought I was going to get the boxes. You know, let me know where I'm going. But we provide you with this curve, and it does two things. It kind of wakes you up because it's unusual. But the curve also pulls you into the galleries. It was also very expensive, this wall, to build. And all of Ondo's walls are expensive to build because they're poured in place. And this particular wall, as I recall, I had some notes. This wall and the concrete wall to the right were something like $900,000. And it was a lot of money. And there was some suggestion that we don't build them. And I felt that we should. Not that anyone asked me, but unfortunately they did ask me. And being the curator, they said, what do you think, Michael? And I iterated a mantra that I used throughout the entire process. I know this is not my money, which it wasn't. I hadn't written a single check and was not going to write a check that would make any difference to the building of this museum. But if it were my money, I'd probably think about building it. It's just such an unusual thing. Then, of course, our board is a very practical board. And very smart. They always ask the toughest questions. And in this case, they said, well, that's great, Michael. It's a circular room. What are you going to put in it? You can't hang paintings. And believe it or not, and I don't want to even admit this to the board, to this day, I had never thought of that. Of course you can't hang paintings in a circular space. You know, they would look ridiculous. And I very cleverly said, oh, no, don't worry, don't worry. I'll find something. Don't worry. This is beautiful. This is a space. Something very special is meant for this space. And as the building progressed forward and we built the wall, I kept thinking, what am I going to put in that space? And I was kind of desperate. I mean, on the one hand, I had grandiose notions. Well, this is what we did put, but let's go. Oops, hold it. Okay, somehow I missed a slide. I had grandiose notions of putting a huge Giacometti in there or a Brancusi, all of which costs millions and millions of dollars. And then I was kind of desperate and I thought, you know, this would make a really great reading room. I mean, that's desperate. I thought, although what I thought was these series of low wooden benches, you know, and a table, sort of like a monk's cell. That would be very cool, right before you walk into the galleries. But that's the kind of cool idea you have when you're desperate. What I did end up putting in was the book with wings. And again, this is something that you're led by intuition. At the time, I was working on an Anselm Kiefer exhibition. And that is a work by Anselm Kiefer, the book with wings. I'm sure many of you know that. This is his house in the south of France. And he makes a lot of paintings and sculptures in this huge 19th century silk factory. But if you look down at the lower left hand of the screen, there's like a tunnel here. And underneath the studio, you go down into this tunnel, and he has tunneled underneath the earth and made these series of installations underground. This is, I photographed Kiefer walking through the tunnel into his caves. Off of this corridor of concrete that he has poured underground are these series of cave-like installations. And in one of them, he had made, there was this light hidden at the very top that you couldn't see the light. But flowing down the wall was lead, like an emanation of lead, of hot lead that had been dripped down the wall. Lead's a very important material for Kiefer because it relates to alchemy. It's the base material for alchemists. It's the material that when superheated would turn to gold. The alchemists really the first, not the first, but they were a combination scientist, religious prophets. And the idea of turning lead to gold was not only a scientific transformation, but it was a spiritual transformation. And in one of his caves, there was this earthen area that he dug out with these tracks in it, and he had hung down a lead pallet. And lead is associated not only with the earth, but it's associated with the planet Saturn. And Saturn is the planet of artists. So here you have this huge lead pallet hanging down. And I thought, wow. And Ondo's room is an earth room. It is like a cave. I mean, there's something that you forget about the concrete when you see how beautiful it's poured. But if you think to what it is, it's just liquid stone that's been poured. And Kiefer had made this lead book. And at the end of the day, it looked beautiful in there. It fit perfectly. What a nice coincidence. And there's something about the lead and the concrete that go together that I really can't explain. But it works. And it's sort of the first chapel in this church of ours. This is a very early drawing of our proposed building that Ondo made. And it's a colored pencil drawing. And what it's showing is the concept of an ngawa, which in Japanese means a space between spaces. It's not outside, it's not inside, it's precisely in between. And it's a very important concept in certain Japanese buildings. It allows nature to come into the building and the building to reach out to nature. What you'll also find interesting is that if you look carefully, you'll see that the Y columns are on the inside of the glass. And we decided that they should be taken out of the glass. That we really wanted that space to be a pure ngawa. And Ondo, after some discussion, agreed. And now what you see in our building, our finished building, are Y columns that have been taken outside of those glass containers. This is a photograph of an early model. And one of the first ngawas that you encounter as you walk north through our galleries has a bronze Etruscan sculpture with a hand reaching up and touching a mirror. And it touches its own reflection. And it's by an artist named Michelangelo Pistoletto. And Pistoletto was an early arte povera artist. This is Italian art of the 1960s, really. Late 1950s, 1960s, early 1970s. And his signature work are these series of steel and mylar paintings in which photographs of everyday people are pasted in to the reflective surface. And then when you walk into the gallery, you see yourself with those people. So in our piece, when you walk into the gallery, what you see is the Etruscan touching his own reflection and reaching out to it, trying to sort of locate its space. But at the same time, what you see is the pawn behind the mirror. So what I was thinking we could do, and Ondo liked this idea very much, was that we could literally bring the reflection of the pawn into the galleries through this mirror. There we go. And there's a really interesting quote by Pistoletto that I have here somewhere, in which he says, well, he talks about the fluidity of space and how space should move in all directions, not one single direction. And keep in mind that it was the Italians, Pistoletto is Italian, that invented perspective in painting. So they were really the first to open up space in painting. And what Pistoletto is doing with his mirror is opening it up completely and completely utilizing the Ngawa concept. Now, it's hard to figure out what this photograph is, but it's a photograph of the very last gallery, well, where the ladder is, the Martin Puryear ladder. And that is one heck of a gallery. And actually, as we speak right now, well, they're probably taking a break. The Martin Puryear ladder is being installed at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, where it is on loan for his retrospective exhibition. Now, when the building was being built, I used to come down to the museum and walk in the spaces. And I remember walking into this one and thinking, wow, this is tough. This is a concrete chamber. In fact, it's not just a concrete chamber. It's a concrete chamber with a concrete chamber stacked on top of it. It goes up 36 feet high. And I had, you know, this shouldn't have been a surprise to me because I was so cavalier in the meetings with Ondo and saying, oh, you know, really, Mr. Ondo, we should have some rooms without white walls, you know, and we're not all about the white cube. I would like a gallery with concrete. I've seen paintings that look fantastic on concrete. And it's true, I have. I have hung paintings on stone walls, on concrete walls, and some paintings look beautiful. What I hadn't expected was the power of this room. And I really didn't know what to do with it. Again, I returned to Brancusi. When all else fails, find a $36 million Brancusi and put it in there, no matter what you do. But unfortunately, we didn't have $36 million, and there aren't even any Brancusis available anyway. So, and this one would have been too big, and it's in Romania. But the idea that this space was so large and that I had to somehow traverse the space, I mean, if you put just something on the floor of that space, the whole chamber is going to seem vacuous to me. And fortunately, being on the building committee, you know, I was there from the drawing stage all the way through the building stage. So I had a good 3 years to worry about this. And I spent much of it doing that. And around the time that that gallery was being built, I visited Martin Puryear in upstate New York. And he had built this fantastic bridge that was a viewing platform for watching birds. And as you know, Puryear works almost exclusively in wood. And when we went back to his studio, on the floor, there was this ladder. And he was just getting ready to wrap it up and literally put it in the rafters and store it away. And he had this other new work that he wanted to show me. And I asked him about the ladder, and he got a little testy about it. You shouldn't be interested in that. Here's the new work. Don't worry about that. That's just something. It's in my collection. Yada, yada, yada. But I couldn't get this thing out of my mind, and this idea of the bridge and the bridging of the spaces, and I had this thing going in my head that, wow, I wonder how long that is. And so right before I left, I said, look, Martin, I wanted to ask you a question about that ladder, and he got a little pissed off and said, look, I told you I don't want to talk about it. I said, how long is it? He says, it's 34 and three-quarters inches long. I said, okay. Good to see you. I left. I came back to the museum, and I talked to our installers, and I said, I saw this thing. It's a ladder. It's about this wide at the base, and it pinches to about this much at the top. It's 34 and three-quarters inches long. I want you to make me one. I don't know how you're going to do it. The one I saw was made of wood, and it was carved. So I don't think you're going to do that, but if you can come up with a way... And Tony Wright, our head installer, called me in a week and he said, I made that thing. And I walked down to the galleries and he'd made it out of PVC pipe. You know, those graduated sizes, so you screwed them together. And I said, let's hang it up. And we hung up the PVC pipe in that space and it looked fantastic. And I just remember turning to the guys and saying, if you think that looks good, wait till you see it in wood. And so I called Martin, and Martin said, I told you I don't want to talk about the ladder. And I said, well, look, Martin, we're building this building by Tadawando. It's really going to be great. I want to show a couple of things. I just want to borrow a couple of special things. If you don't like it, I will take it down within a week and send it right back to you. You just come and you look. So he said, okay. And he came, and he loved it. And that was a very good thing because this is one piece. The crate for this is 38 feet long. It weighs thousands and thousands of pounds. It cost me $20,000 to ship it one way. I didn't realize that was the kind of bluff I was playing in case he didn't like it. But at the end of the day, he liked it. And then... The final story about this piece, which I always have to tell, is that this is proof that no good deed goes unpunished. So the board saw the piece and said, wow, that looks fantastic. He should give it to us. And Martin saw the piece and said, geez, I didn't know that piece was that good. And he put an outrageous price on it. And for literally a year, we had this piece in the galleries, and Martin owned it. And at one point, I went to the board and said, look, everybody's got to come together on this. You can never expect an artist to give you something. I mean, it's a very rare thing, number one. And then I went to David McKee, who is Martin's dealer, which was much easier than going to Martin, and said, look, David, you guys got to come back on this. If you can find a place to show this where it will look any better, be my guest and sell it. So at the end of the day, after a year and a half, we were able to buy it. And that was a good thing. And I think there's something about, it isn't just that the ladder climbs the space. There is that, and how it wiggles through the space of this clear story room. There's something about the fact that both Ondo, and I'm convinced of this, both Ondo and Puryear come from working class backgrounds. Both of them are essentially, well, you can't say that Martin's self-taught, but they self-taught themselves to work with their materials from a very early age. Ondo was a laborer working on construction sites as a young man. And he used to go to the construction sites and watch the carpenters work and watch the builders work. Puryear learned to make his own guitars from the time he was 14. And his father was a woodworker in the basement of their house, although he went on to study at Yale Art School. But to me, there's something about the handmade nature, the almost primitive quality of both of these objects that make them work together. The same way that the lead and the concrete work together, this ladder and that room work together. Now, there's no question in my mind that the most daunting room in this building is the central pavilion. This pavilion is so daunting that I remember in the middle of the process, Ondo took me aside at one meeting and said, "I have a really interesting space for you." Now, this is something you never want to hear from an architect. It's like your interior decorator saying, "I have a really interesting bathroom concept for you." You just, you know, interesting is not what you want. What you want is sheer beauty. And when an architect says something is interesting, what it really means is that now I'm going to be a sculptor. And what I know from a lot of past experience is that sculptors don't like to show inside of other sculptures. They like to be the sculptor. And he made this room, and I walked into it, and I thought, whoa, this is intense. Not just because it's a clear story space like the other space, but because it has this incredible Y column at the end of it. So there's a couple of ways of going with this. And my first thought was to go alpha male and get a Richard Serra in there. I'll deal with this Y column. I'll blow this baby out of here with some Corten steel. And then that thought went away. And I thought, no, maybe the way to go is to take the very tallest room in the building and put the very shortest sculpture. Let Ondo be Ondo, and let Carl Andre be Carl Andre. And the great thing about Andre is that Andre's work is anti-figurative, unless you consider the participant walking on these things as the figure. And it's essentially, the greatest work, I think, is anti-vertical. It's about horizontal stretch. And Ondo's idea is that sculpture could be road. The idea of standing in the center of a road and looking that way, and it just keeps going in all directions. And in installing this, you're looking down from the second floor. We installed it so that the first plate, and these plates are literally a quarter of an inch high. Each of these steel plates, the first plates are installed underneath the platform on the second floor. So you don't really know where this road begins. And it stretches out. To the Y column, and literally to the water. Where you're going is the water. The destination, I realized, is not the Y column. The Y column is a functional support. The destination in this room is to the water. And the one thing about the water in this whole project, and it's something that I don't think any of us realized except Ondo, we had asked him when we were doing the building for a water feature. And he gave us a 4-acre pond. Because it's hot here, and we thought a water feature would be nice, a fountain of this or that, gives us this beautiful pond. And from the get-go, we knew that it would be beautiful. What I didn't realize was how much it affects the mood of the building. The surface of the water changes every hour. It changes daily. It changes seasonally. There are times when it looks like a babbling brook. There are times when there's a little chop. It's almost waves. It's like you feel on that at that last pavilion, you feel like you're on the North Atlantic or something, like the Caspar David Friedrich's Monk by the Sea. I don't exaggerate at all. But, you know, you have to have an imagination. You got to exaggerate. And this is a shot of my idea of why this is there, is that this road takes you right out to the water. Now, one of Ondo's concepts behind the pond was that the pond would be surrounded by vegetation, and that what he wanted to do was create what he called an arbor for art, which is a very clever thing, a way of sort of protecting the museum. Who would have known we would have had this Barnett Shale boom and all of this development going on around the museum? But it's a good thing that Ondo did these plantings, or we would be very exposed to all that was going around this cultural district. And for the longest time, I had thought that this idea of an arbor for art was the perfect thing, that you really shouldn't pollute it with art. You should. The problem with sculpture gardens, quote unquote, which I think is different than an arbor for art, is that sculpture gardens become a forest of sculptures. They're just a bunch of soldiers out there plopped around, and you have to walk between them. And the better thing is to have nature and art mingle together, or just leave it alone and let nature do its thing, which for 5 years we did. And then in Madison Square Park in New York, this artist Roxy Payne had made this stainless steel tree structure. And these are 2 4,000-pound stainless steel trees made out of stainless steel pipes. And it's called Conjoined. And it was a way to kind of focus this space, because no one was going out there. It kind of remained this anonymous, empty knoll. And now people are going out there on a much more regular basis. Some to just look around and look back at the museum. And we've sited it so that it frames the gallery pavilions. Some people go to have their wedding pictures taken underneath it. That I didn't see coming. But it's a part of this idea of art and nature working together, which is what we wanted in this building in the first place. Now, in regards to the outside of the building, some people would say, and I can't disagree